Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammang sanghang namassam. I've mentioned a couple times already just the importance of developing a continuity of attention, of awareness. And this, I think, is it's a theme in any venue for practice, for meditation. But I think particularly for those of you who've come here, it's billed as a Bhayagiri monastic retreat. So the opportunity to use the kind of simulation of a monastic environment in order to cultivate this period of retreat for practice. And I think for those of us who've been trained under Ajahn Chah and a lot of the Thai forest masters, that element of using all of the different circumstances of life, of duties, of living in community as a basis for practice is a very strong ethos or a very strong flavor. So I thought I'd just talk about that this afternoon. I was one of the say as an example of that, I was some years ago we had a very senior Thai forest monk come and visit us nearby actually. And they ended up purchasing property adjacent to Bhayagiri for this monk, a group of Thai people in the Bay Area. And he was a direct disciple of Umpu Khao, who was a student of Ajahn Mun. And there's actually a book about Lumpu Khao, Ajahn Khao, Analio, written by Ajahn Mahabua. And anyway, the group brought this senior monk and they were setting up this place, and he was going to be coming once a year to teach. And so the very first time that he came, we went over and paid respects, and he saw that we were Western disciples of Ajahn Chah, and he was very delighted, and he said, "Oh yeah, I remember meeting Ajahn Sumedho. He and I were laying bricks with at Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, and making the monastery wall around the monastery." So it's like it's very much a part of life, and we probably won't be doing any bricklaying this retreat, but it's just sort of these are part of the sort of the daily life and different things that need to be done are a part of the practice, a part of the training, a part of the what one picks up as a focus for awareness and mindfulness and investigation, reflection. So that the kind of the boundary of this is practice, this is meditation practice, and that is not meditation practice doesn't really hold so well. And I think it's very helpful to using that as a reflection as we go about our daily life here. And various people are doing different yogi jobs and helping the retreat function, and that's that's both an opportunity for mindfulness, but it's an opportunity for dana, for generosity, for giving, so that and when we take it on as a say as an opportunity for giving for the benefit and sharing our giving of our service, giving of our time for the benefit of others, then it has an effect on the mind. It has a different effect of saying doing something in a kind of begrudging way and making it complicated or not applying oneself to it. Inevitably there's, and certainly in a monastery that's the case. It isn't as if everybody delights in everything that they're doing and everybody gets along harmoniously, it's all sort of everybody's floating on clouds of metta and karuna. It usually doesn't work that way. But as a vehicle for investigating our experience and what is the experience and how do we use it, how do we hold it, how can we be mindful of it, how can we be mindful of really delighting in something. You've got a particular chore, or there's something, some particular aspect of the routine that you really delight in. Some particular chore you like to do, or somebody really likes chanting, especially when you have a group of 60-odd people. Some people are going to really like chanting, some people are going to be not so enthusiastic, and some might just be kind of neutral, and that's ordinary. But then, even if we delight in it, how do we hold it? Because we can get excited. We want it to repeat that experience. We want that experience to last longer. So then we get trapped, even by good experiences. And similar with experiences of where aversion or boredom come up. And that the way of practice is really looking at those different experiences in the light of Dhamma, in the sense of, is there suffering, or is there not suffering? How do we, if there is suffering, how to ameliorate that, how to work with that? Ajahn Sumedho tells the story of when he first went to stay with Ajahn Chah, and part of the routine of the monastery was getting out, and in the afternoon after water hauling and then sweeping the monastery and sweeping the trails. Once a week, you do a really, really complete sweep and cleaning of the whole monastery. And and he didn't like it. He didn't, so he'd usually, the bell would go for the sweeping, and he'd usually wait. And wait until kind of the last minute, and everybody else was out sweeping. He'd finally show up. And then, of course, by the time he got there, most of the good brooms were taken. So he ends up with this scrubby broom with a few scraggly sticks left on it. And so then he's going around scratching the earth and chasing a few leaves here and there and just doing it really no enthusiasm, no interest, not very happy. You know, why do we have to do this? As soon as we finish the sweeping, those leaves are going to fall anyway. It is going on. And it's very logical and rational. But creating suffering. And then he was sort of absorbed in some particular thought or mood, standing with his broom. And then Ajahn Chah came up beside him. And he didn't notice, but he just asked, "Oh, Sumedho, is Wat Pa Phong suffering?" And then he walked away. And he started thinking, "No, is Wat Pa Phong suffering? No, actually not. Wat Pa Phong's kind of nice. But it's when I'm living here and I resist or get averse or get caught up in some proliferation, I create my own suffering." That was a real big insight for him, the actual situation, the place that we're in, isn't really suffering. Even though we can suffer in different places, and all of us who were students of Ajahn Chah, we certainly did suffer at Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, but certainly wasn't the monastery's fault. Using the circumstances for reflection, for investigation, and for cultivation of mindfulness. When I was thinking of talking about this after lunch, and I remembered a discourse that I looked up and then tried to. I'd memorized it before, but it wasn't sticking, so I had to write it down. And because it's one of those lists, wonderful lists out of the Buddha's teachings, out of the numerical discourses. And it's a discourse to Mahapajapati Gotami, who is the Buddha's stepmother. She was the first bhikkhuni. And she's been leading the community for some undefined amount of time already. She goes to the Buddha and with the intention to ask permission and to take leave and go to live in solitude and to practice diligently for the goal. And so she asks for a teaching of the Dhamma in brief. She says, "So I might dwell alone, withdrawn, heedful, ardent, and resolute." And the Buddha gives her eight particular ways of reflecting on what is Dhamma, what's the training, what's the teaching of the Buddha. And he says, those things that lead to dispassion, not to passion, and one can be assured, you can definitely recognize, this is the Dhamma, this is the discipline, this is the teaching of the Tathagata. And those things that lead to detachment, not to bondage or attachment. Those things that lead to shedding, not to accumulating. Those things that lead to fewness of desires, not to strong desires. Those things that lead to contentment, not to discontent. Those things that lead to seclusion, not to entanglement. Those things that lead to the arousing of energy, not to laziness. Those things that lead to being easy to support, not to being difficult to support. Those things, you should definitely recognize, this is the Dhamma, this is the discipline, this is the teaching of the Tathagata. And it's a very simple and direct teaching. And Mahapajapati took that teaching, went into seclusion, and that was the basis of her cultivation at that point, and that's where she realized Nibbana, full enlightenment. So those are themes that we can be contemplating and reflecting on, so that they're recognizing what direction does the mind go in, and how to encourage it in the direction of dispassion, of detachment, of shedding, of fewness of desires, of contentment, of seclusion, of arousing of energy, of being easy to support. These are qualities that we that kind of enhance the Dhamma, that enhance those qualities that allow us to allow the Dhamma to shine forth in our heart, allow truth to shine forth. And when we pay attention to the qualities, then the things that we do you realize, well, the things that we do are, everything falls into, under the umbrella of a practice of training, so that we can be, using the chanting to develop arousing of energy, contentment. We use the meditation itself. We use the chores and different duties that we have. We use the eating, and you reflect on the Buddha's discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, and the occasions of establishing mindfulness cover everything. Walking, going forward, going backward, stretching out one's limbs, going to the toilet, urinating, defecating. These are all opportunities for... Nothing's really outside of the bounds of being mindful and recognizing what qualities are arising, and are they in accord with Dhamma, or are they not in accord? And then we can be directing our attention, and particularly the aspects of reflection, really bringing up reminders. It's like in the the commentaries, they collect together the different bases of meditation, of gamatana. There's 40 of them. And there's a whole section of them that are specifically recollections. So 10 of them, the recollections of the Buddha, recollections of Dhamma, just bringing to mind aspects of experience, bringing to mind and bringing to memory, recollecting occasions of generosity, occasions of virtue, because those brighten the mind. They bring a quality of clarity. So using the thought process to encourage the mind in the direction of Dhamma. Because sometimes we spend a lot of energy, you know, trying not to think. Sort of like, if only I could stop thinking, I would be peaceful. And the reality actually is that even if you are able to stop thinking through a force of will, there's a tension there, because it's the mind isn't bright. It's kind of like one has pushed away thought, but one can use thought to recollect things that are wholesome, that are beneficial. Now, as we go about our day, you're paying attention to the ways that we attachment, because that's one of the how to encourage detachment rather than bondage and attachment. How do we encourage contentment rather than discontent? And just recognizing sometimes how we, the aspects of, we can get attached in the very mundane and ways. And when you look at it, you say, oh man, I can't believe I did that. But that, just getting, because there's a tendency to, we are driven, fear and that seeking of security. They're like just trying to make sure that we get our right spot in the dining hall, or trying to eat at a particular place, so that we're trying to get everything set, so that it's settled, it's secure, and which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's important to look at the ways that we tend to try to manipulate the conditions around us, and what's driving that, and what kind of view, what kind of attachment, what kind of fear. And that's where we really learn. It's like when Ajahn Sumedho went back to Thailand the first time, after being in England for 5 years, and he was enthusiastic about how things were going, and people were interested in Dhamma, people were interested in the precepts, people were interested in the both the lay people and people interested in ordination, and people were practicing well. The monastery was kind of starting to gain momentum, and he was very enthusiastic. And Ajahn Chah listened for a bit, and he said, "You're not going to learn too much from those people. If it's just all these good things happening, you're not going to learn very much." So it was just that sense of putting the shining another light. Of course, Ajahn Chah was wise enough to know that that wasn't the whole picture. But because we tend to, we gravitate toward the things that we like, we want, that make us feel secure, that make us feel comfortable, and we pull away from where we get averse to, things that do make us uncomfortable. So, from the perspective of Dhamma and investigation, to be willing to look at what's going on underneath that? Is there attachment there? Is there contentment? Or is there discontent? Is this coming out of a fewness of wishes? Or is it coming through many wishes that I'm trying to get my way too much? So that is very much a flavor of a monastic training, and I think all of the people who live in the monastery, we've all hit places of being frustrated or irritated by the circumstances that we're in. But for those of us who continue to stick with it and work with it, then there is a freedom that comes from not being intimidated by circumstances. So that whether things are comfortable or whether they're not, one can not being intimidated by, not falling into the habit of the mind that just wants to pull away. So being willing to turn attention onto our experience, and whether it's pleasant or whether it's unpleasant. I've often said for a Bhayagiri, and for those people who've been to a Bhayagiri, you'll recognize this, I'm quite confident that a Bhayagiri will be able to maintain itself as a monastery into the future. Because there's on a certain level, there's no way you can make a Bhayagiri comfortable. The terrain is challenging, and as much as we make our buildings and do the development of the physical aspect of the monastery, I mean, it does lend a certain convenience. But in the end, it's hard to make it really comfortable, which is a good thing, because whether you notice that if you look at history, whether it's Buddhist tradition or Christian tradition and the monastic traditions, a monastery, if it's successful, basically becomes comfortable, and then the practice falls apart. Mm. So that there's a danger to that. So that to be able to recognize, okay, how do I use this? How do I develop a mindfulness and awareness with these very basic aspects of living, walking, sitting, standing, lying down, and cultivate dispassion, cultivate detachment, cultivate shedding, and cultivate fewness of desires, cultivate contentment, cultivate seclusion, cultivate arousing of energy, cultivate being easy to support. And those are, that's when we really start the kind of a practice that has a flavor of what the Buddha is pointing to. Because what the Buddha is pointing to is actually, you know, somewhat straightforward. All conditioned things are impermanent. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory. All things are not self. On a philosophical level, one can take that and reflect on it, investigate it, and verify that. But does it actually change us? So it's when we take those investigation or those fundamental truths and bring them into walking, sitting, standing, lying down. Whether we're feeling that we've got energy or that we're feeling tired, whether we're feeling kind of sick or whether we're feeling kind of at a peak of good health, whether we're feeling really uplifted by something or we're feeling challenged by something. How do we bring our experience in and investigate it and reflect on it so that it leads to a quality of dispassion? I think that's it's the very first one, and it has it's an important flavor for the heart to reflect in terms of dispassion, and dispassion doesn't mean just dissing things and pushing it away or reacting out of aversion, because aversion is a passion. The dispassion is a cooling of the heart, so that there's a clarity and stillness. So that when we allow a clarity and stillness to rise up in the heart through our continuity of mindfulness, and that happens when we develop a continuity of awareness and attention, things fall away. It's a natural response. When we take an interest in our meditation object, take an interest in our experience, and the mind engages in it, other things fall away because it's satisfying. And so there's rather than a feeding of passion and distraction, there's a dispassion and settling that's incredibly satisfying. And that's a flavor of Dhamma. And, you know, it's not a word that's used in modern 20th century culture, 21st century cultures. Dispassion doesn't get a whole lot of press. But it's a quality that you know, as a Buddhist practitioner, you start realizing that the nuances and the flavor of it is one that's written deeply satisfying. And you know, on a certain level, especially people that are here instead of engaging in whatever happens at Thanksgiving, which is, and I'm just a kind of a foreigner who doesn't, only get a secondhand information about what Thanksgiving is about, but it doesn't remind me of dispassion. So those you know the opportunity for dispassion, people are making a conscious choice to be in a situation that inclines the mind and the heart to this kind of settling, and so that taking the from the time we wake up in the morning and applying the mind, applying attention. One of the things that one does need to be attentive to is taking oneself too seriously, because there's a mindful meditator and there's a mindful meditator, and there and so when we take ourselves too seriously and we try too hard, we get in the way, and so much of practice is actually learning how to get out of the way. Allow these fundamental truths to resonate in the heart, and pay attention to what it feels like. I think that's Ajahn Chah would be asked over and over and over again why, how he could teach Westerners, how to teach foreigners the Dhamma, because he didn't speak any other foreign languages, he didn't speak English, and then especially in the very early days, when we arrived, none of us knew Thai. So, the people were really curious. How could he teach people like that? And one of the ways that he responded was by he invariably had a glass of warm water beside himself. He'd been drink warm water, warm tea, and he said, "Well, this is a glass of warm water." But when I say warm water in Thai, you understand it. But if I say it in another language, if you said it in another language, then you wouldn't understand it. Say it in whatever warm water is in Indian language, or in Chinese, or in French, or in English. It's all different. You can't understand it. He said, but the language isn't so important. What's important is stick your finger in the water, then you'll know what warm water is. He said, and that's the language of Dhamma. It isn't in the words, it's in the experience. So that being able to experience happiness and suffering, being able to experience gladness and sadness, all of the range of feelings that we experience. It's a language of feeling. As we approach the Dhamma, that feeling is one of it's one of peace, it's one of stillness, of stability. And those are things that we can feel ourselves. It's just by having words for it doesn't necessarily describe it, but it's finding ways that we can experience that. And that's this is what the practice is for, and learning how to implement mindfulness and clear comprehension in the things that we do. And it isn't, it isn't just mindfulness in the sense of if I'm just mindful enough, I would I'd be able to be present with the Dhamma. There's a there's a clear comprehension that is it has to accompany that, and that clear comprehension is there's an application of discernment and self-reflection, self-awareness. It's like I was talking about this morning of fracturing my pelvis 20 years ago. I was really mindful when I did that. But it wasn't much clear comprehension happening. You should be able to sort of figure out 2 + 2 and say, well, okay, if I do this, that's not the brightest thing to be doing. But, you know, I was very mindful as I was doing it. And I'm sure, and I can, there's lots of times I've been mindful and it ended up in suffering again. I'm sure everybody can relate to that. So that sense of, you know, mindfulness, clear comprehension, self-reflection, self-awareness, those they work together, they go together. And then bringing it back to this quality of dispassion, of settling, allowing the heart to truly become peaceful. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning, or this afternoon.